to you for the beautiful music. Really appreciate the music and your song choices. I think we're quite spot on for the topic today. What I want to do is give you sort of a practical overview of what mental health even is, how it is related to substance use. We'll get into just a touch of brain science, which is an interesting thing to get into on Sunday morning, regardless of where you're sitting. And then I wanted to sort of land the plane with some real practical tools that you guys can put into practice the moment you walk out these doors in your own life and in the life of those that you might come into contact with. So let's start with some definitions. So what is mental health in general? Mental health has a lot to do with our emotions, has a lot to do with the thinking skills we use to make judgments and decisions, and it has a lot to do with our relationships and the way that we interact with one another. In other words, mental health is sort of the thing behind all of the other things in your life. So whether or not you're actively talking about mental health, it's influencing your everyday activities, right? So it's kind of a strange thing that it's become, it's getting better, but it had become sort of a taboo in our culture for quite some time, right? I would reckon only in the last maybe decade or two has it become a little bit less taboo to even say the words out loud, mental health or depression, anxiety or addiction. And I'm grateful that that change has happened, but the fact that it influences everything else, a good way to describe what we experience, okay, and how that affects our mental health. So this sort of light green oval you see represents all of the stress or difficulties or traumatic experiences that you might have in your life. And we all have those, right? You can probably count a few on your fingers just from this week where you got your heart racing a little bit and it made you feel kind of upset, or maybe it was a memory of something that, that happened long ago. And when we experience those things, we end up experiencing symptoms and reactions to those things, right? And that puts us somewhere on this spectrum of illness to wellness, right? Some of us will experience more symptoms of wellness. Some of us will experience more symptoms of illness. At any point in our lives, we might find ourselves at a different point on this spectrum. I think the most important thing to notice about this model is that it's connected in the middle, right? So it's not mentally ill people over here and mentally well people over here. It's just us. Right? I know that the concept of us and unity is near and dear to the Unitarian Church. So that's sort of a preaching to the choir type point. But sometimes we forget about this when we start feeling those symptoms of illness. Sometimes we even have a tendency to otherize ourselves. We start isolating ourselves when we're experiencing those things. We start putting ourselves in a whole other category of humanity, thinking no one else will understand what we're going through. So if you catch nothing else today, just catch this. You're not alone in what you're experiencing, right? It's just us, and we're experiencing different points on this spectrum of everyday life. Thing is, when we do experience more of those symptoms of illness, and we do experience more of those stressors or traumas in our life, we're gonna find ways to cope with it. Some of us will cope with that stress in a positive way, in a healthy way. Some of us, most of us, will cope with that in a relatively unhealthy way. I don't know about you, but I'm a snacker when I get really anxious. So I can power my way through a box of Cheez-Its or a sleeve of Oreos in a single setting, and that's my record so far. But that's not necessarily the best way for me to process those feelings, right? And obviously, substance use falls into an unhealthy coping strategy, right? Oftentimes having some sort of underlying mental health struggle attached to it. That underlying piece is what's happening right in here, okay? So your brain is a lot like a plate of spaghetti, right, that's just kind of mashed inside your skull. And all those noodles are all connected around, and they create these electrical pathways and these neurochemical pathways. They pass these hormones and chemicals that give signals to your body to react in certain ways and give signals to your mind to respond and process what you're experiencing in certain ways, right? And they're interconnected, right? So when you experience something on the outside, it triggers a whole variety of things happening inside. Right? And some of those are easy and just kind of happen in the background. You know, some of those are not so easy, and you ruminate on those things. All of that is connected and hardwired into your brain activity. But when we start experiencing stress, there's a very specific area of the brain that is typically associated with those feelings, and that's this part right here. I'm going to try to stand out of y'all's way over here on the right-hand side, okay? This part of the brain is called the amygdala or the and the hippocampus. Okay, they're kind of like right next to each other in the deepest part of your brain. Okay, it's one of the oldest parts of human evolution. All right, so this is the part of our brain that we share with the animal kingdom as well. Okay, they all have this same area of the brain that triggers very similar responses when they experience stress, okay? And you'll notice the amygdala and hippocampus are attached to your emotions, your heart rate, your breathing, and a little bit dipping up into memory processing. And those are sort of like the core things of what it means to be alive, right? My blood pumping and oxygen going in and out of my lungs and how I feel about an experience and whether or not I remember that experience accurately. Right? So when we start experiencing stress, this becomes super overactive, and it triggers the release of dopamine and cortisol. And that release that hormone is usually responsible for things like feelings of either pleasure with the dopamine, right, and motivation, and with cortisol, feelings of stress or anxiety. Okay, so let's dive in a little bit deeper here to talk about those hormones. When you start experiencing stress, again, I'm going to step out of the way so my friends over here can, I'll just speak loudly enough, okay, if that's okay without the mic. When you experience stress, the area of your brain called the prefrontal cortex that's responsible for decision-making and skills and thinking, that starts to kind of go offline. It slows down. The volume turns down in that area of the brain, okay? The area of your brain responsible for, like, physicality, movement, balance, coordination, and all that, that also starts to slow down a little bit, which is not very helpful if you're in danger, right? The area responsible for communication also starts to get a little bit murky. So it gets a little bit more difficult to tell someone else how you are feeling when you are feeling stressed. Is this starting to feel real life to anybody, right? And then, like I said, this area of the brain gets kind of overactive during those stressful experiences, right? When it gets overactive, adrenaline and cortisol, the two stress hormones, are what you feel coursing through your veins, okay? So you start to get that fight, flight, or freeze response. Anybody familiar with this from like Psych 101? So fight, flight, or freeze, what happens here is that the dopamine, the pleasure hormone, gets dialed way back. We don't respond to that as easily when we're stressed out. And the stress hormones get turned way up. And we start getting that like racing heart rate, shortness of breath, tightness in our neck and shoulders and jaw and fingers and hands. Some of us are preparing to push back and defend ourselves. Some of us trying to shut down and go internally when we start feeling that stress or that anxiety. Some of us just leave. Right, we just get out of there. Some of us might kind of freeze, and that's particularly true when it comes to children who have experienced a trauma. Sometimes that deer in the headlights response is the only strategy they have to help protect themselves, right? But all of our brains are doing similar things here in that amygdala and hippocampus area, all right? But when you add something like substance use, which is a negative coping strategy, an unhealthy coping strategy with stress, it does something interesting to your brain, and it affects the same area. Okay, so right here, the same area of the brain, the amygdala and hippocampus, when you have a substance introduced to that cycle, it triggers a massive release of dopamine, that pleasure hormone, okay, that pleasure and motivation hormone. And it's way more than you're used to, okay? So you're coming into a situation with stress with a deficit of dopamine, and then you're manufacturing like a floodgate of dopamine to replace that deficit. All right, so the solution overdoes it compared to the need. Does that make sense? All right, the solution gives us way more dopamine than what we're used to. Because, you know, when you get a high five from a friend, or you're intimate with a partner, or you get an A on your test or a promotion at work, a little bit of dopamine is released in all of those instances. But when you use a substance, whether that is alcohol or cannabis or a harder substance like a pill or heroin or methamphetamine, it's a floodgate of dopamine, way more than you need. And it starts to create some really negative reactions in the brain. All right, it's way too much than what you need. Once you experience that trauma and you introduce the substances, we start to see some real negative consequences, right? That would include things like way too much adrenaline, cortisol that gets built up and never gets used, which creates sort of a toxicity in your bodily balance. It can lead to other problems like heart disease and higher rates of cancer incidence and things like that. Who knew that just being stressed out is attached to those things, right? These physical outcomes. There's long-term physiological memories that are attached to those trauma. This is where we start developing things like triggers, where the scent of cologne or perfume reminds me of this trauma experienced, or the sound of a car horn reminds me of the car accident I was in, or the sound of someone yelling reminds me of the time I got yelled at when I was a kid, right? These triggers are our brain trying to prevent us from going into that danger again. But ultimately, it gets really hard to live with all these triggers, right? It's really difficult to make it through these processes and these everyday life experiences when we have these constant stress triggers happening, right? ultimately, that toxicity leads to other physical and mental health problems, like poor coping skill development, higher rates of depression and anxiety, higher rates of heart disease and cancers, etc. So this is just with stress and trauma. When you add substances to that, it's dramatically negative, right? And it doesn't have to be just illegal substances. Our brain will respond to any addictive substance in the same way. We are all capable of becoming addicted to a substance. There's no one brain that is, you know, less likely, right? All of us kind of share that. So this is where folks like myself and like Sue step in and start trying to make a difference, right? We're trying to figure out, what do we do to intervene when it comes to the development of substance use disorders, when that negative coping strategy becomes habitual, when it becomes a survival mechanism as opposed to just a stress relief? Because ultimately that's what's happening with substance use, right? Those who are addicted to a substance are not just trying to get high. They're trying to find an escape from something, more or less. And ultimately, when their body and their brain becomes reliant upon that substance to trigger that massive dopamine release, it becomes about staving off withdrawal, not getting high. It becomes about not feeling sick, not getting high, right? So all of these negative stereotypes and stigmas that we've associated with the use of substances are not necessarily accurate, right? Most of our friends and family members who are suffering from this disease are just trying not to feel sick, which is a relatively logical thing, but we're using negative coping strategies to achieve that outcome. All right, so just to dive into the sort of the prevalence of what's happening, a lot of leaders that are sort of part of the mental health and behavioral health field here in Henderson County work together to do a behavioral health assessment in the community over the past year. It was led by the Henderson County Community Foundation and was facilitated by a consulting agency called Community Solutions. So they were sort of our lead partners in just organizing the process itself. It was completed throughout the year of 2022, guided by a leadership committee led by yours truly, and included people from multiple sectors, people from law enforcement, from schools, from healthcare, from counseling and therapy, from businesses. What?
LGBT.
Yes, there were members of the queer community, Henderson County Pride, the Alliance for Diversity was a part of it. There's multiple sectors represented on this steering committee, trying to figure out, number one, how many people is this affecting, and number two, what are the trends that we're seeing in Henderson County? This included primary data sources, so that would be like surveys. It also, that's like more quantitative, like counts, numbers, right? It also included community input workshops where folks got together and actually just talked about it and shared their stories and shared their experiences of what they're going through. There was also secondary data sources that included both state and local community needs assessments, things that have been done by the hospital system, Hendricks Regional Health, as well as the health department, that kind of coincide with the data that we were looking at. And then, of course, there were some ways we needed to measure how we were going to make any meaningful change in some of these prevalence points. So we chose sort of four primary indicators. So what I want to do, just to illustrate sort of the prevalence, is share those four primary indicators with you. The indicators that this committee of people that calls themselves the Henderson County Health Partnership is going to be working on trying to improve. Okay. The first is related to the number of poor mental health days self-reported per month. So in the data that we collected during this survey, we saw that in Hendricks County, most residents reported about 4.4 poor mental health days per month in previous years. Okay, so a little bit less than a business week, which if you multiply that out times 52 weeks, that's a significant portion of your year that you're not feeling very good. Right, that's more than you would expect. Right, the next indicator we chose to look at was, of course, the suicide rate, which we heard of a tragedy already today. In 2020, there were 1,017 people who died in the state of Indiana, and of those in the state of Indiana, 25 of them were Hendricks County community members. The reason why this data is a couple years old is because a lot of those death records have to go through investigations at the coroner's office to determine the true causes of death, but it's been around the 20-ish mark for, a while, about a decade now. And that seems like a small number, but that's 25 people we know and love. Right? So it's not small to us. The third indicator we chose was emergency room visits due to any drug. So this is typically what we call an overdose, but this would be non-fatal. So we made it to a hospital. These folks were brought back out of that overdose situation. Their lives were saved. In 2020 in Henderson County, there were 229. And that's per 100,000 population. And so that's represented as a rate. So it's a lot of people, a lot more than you might expect. The fourth indicator that we chose to focus on was deaths involving any substance, any drug overdose. And in Hendricks County, we had 20 people last year die. 20 people. So this is a bummer, right? This is a bummer, yes. It's actually two rates compared to each other. The graph is really confusing, though. It looks exactly like what you're saying, but both are representing a number per 100,000 population. So for the state of Indiana, this number, 264, is per 100,000, but there are, how many million people that live in the state of Indiana? So it's just comparing the rates compared to each other. In Hendricks County, we have about 180,000 people who live here, so if you multiply that out, that averages around 250 people died in 2020 for us, like an exact count. But the rate averages out to about 220 per 100,000. Good question, thank you. So those are sort of the four primary indicators that we chose as a steering committee that we wanted to make a difference in, right? We want to save lives, we want to make those who are living's lives a little healthier, a little happier, a little more joy-filled. So in order to do that, the members of these steering committees and those who are still practicing as part of the Hendricks County Health Partnership built what's called the Community Action Plan. The Community Action Plan has 9 different strategies with accompanying action steps that we plan to complete over the next 4 or 5 years. Those strategies touch all of the sectors that were part of the steering committee, but primarily it focuses on the clients that those agencies and those sectors serve. Right, it's for the public and it's built by the public, and that's really our goal here, is to make a difference in our community. Instead of walking through you through all 9 strategies, because that'd take us probably an hour and a half, there's a link, hendrickshealthpartnership.org, and that's something you can just bookmark on your phone or write down on your program, and you can visit that and look at the strategies yourself. These strategies are all collaborative, and they're led by collaborative entities, coalitions. And there are multiple coalitions that are kind of under the umbrella of the health partnership. Here's just a little graphic illustration. I'll step out of the way for you all over here. So the health partnership is kind of like the top umbrella, and it represents our local coordinating council, which is focused on substance use, mental health and wellness coalition, the system of care, as well as a prevention group called the CCB. All of those are now one entity under the partnership. And then we divide that into lots of special interest subcommittees. And each of those special interest subcommittees is sort of a niche of sorts that meets a specific need for a specific group of people, including but not limited to substance use, veterans, crisis intervention training for law enforcement officers so that they're more able to respond to mental health crises without using force. The Stability Builders Network and the Food Pantry Coalition, which is focused on poverty alleviation. There's a faith-based subcommittee that's currently in the process of being formed. A suicide prevention group and survivors of suicide, which is the Lost Team. There's a domestic violence and child abuse prevention group. It's a crisis response team that does debriefing after there's been a tragic incident and the Community Foundation serving on those consultant fronts, kind of influencing all of those subcommittees by being members on those and offering us best practices. So all of these entities, all of these collaboratives are all part of enacting and completing this community action plan. And here's the best part. There's no membership fee. We just meet once a month, and a lot of these strategies are as easy as making warm connections with those that are in your network, or in your family, or in your friend group. Oftentimes, it's just getting people to the table that's the hardest part, right? So if you're interested in maybe being a part of one of these collaboratives, feel free to shoot me an email or come talk to me afterwards, and I'd love to help you get involved. It's open to anyone. It's for Hendricks County community members, and it's operated by Hendricks County community members. But I promise to give you some practical tools. So that's where I'm going to end today, is give you some practical tools of what can you do to help yourself or help someone else who might be struggling, whether it be with something mental health related, like depression, anxiety, or similar, or whether it be related to substance use. The first thing you can do to help is do your best to address and reduce stigma or bias in your own heart. Okay, this usually shows up in one of four ways, internal, interpersonal, consumption, and systemic. So internal is just the biases we carry around that we don't always recognize, right? Many of us were raised in generations where the only introduction to substance use we had was how it was represented on the cop TV show that we watched, on Saturday nights. And that's usually a very stigmatized version of that story that's not necessarily true or accurate. Right? Some of us might have experienced a hardship with a family member who was dealing with depression and anxiety, and that trauma lives with us now vicariously, and that might be the only idea we have about mental health, because no one has told us what we could do to help or how our family member might be able to improve their own life. right? Those internal biases can play a big role in how we treat people and how we think about people. Interpersonal shows up in more about, you know, with our relationships with one another, right? You might have that one friend that's always calling you with something they need your advice on. And then it's always kind of a decision when that phone starts ringing, like, do I answer today or not? You know, am I going to be able to help or not? And frankly, one of the best things you can do is just listen. You don't always have to have the answer. Maybe it makes you feel a little uncomfortable in the moment, but that answering, that text message back, that coffee date or tea date or lunch date can be world-changing for that person, just to know that they're not alone when they're in that moment of hardship. When it comes to consumption, what I'm talking about here is the media we consume, right? We consume a lot of different types of media, whether it's online or in our papers or in magazines or on movies or TV shows that don't provide accurate representations of these struggles. So we need to be careful how much of that we take as truth. We need to recognize what is stigmatizing and what is not when we are consuming it. And then systemic is maybe the least obvious version of stigma. It's built into policies and laws and business practices where, you know, some insurance companies don't provide mental health benefits, right? Sometimes you might feel really bummed out because you lost a loved one or you're going through a hard relational conflict. And you might need that day or two to yourself to organize your thoughts or attend a therapy appointment, but you're not offered that day off by your workplace. Right? That is systemic stigma against these issues, right? So it's important to address those. The next thing you can do to help is try to think upstream about these problems. What I mean by upstream is that oftentimes we just think about the Band-Aid solutions, right? Okay, my friend or my family member is addicted to alcohol. Let's get them to be sober. Okay, that's important, right? But what's causing that substance use? We need to go up the stream, right? Downstream is a substance use and addiction. Yes, of course, we got to address that medically especially, but what's causing it? Are they sad? Are they anxious? Are they trying to escape something? Are they being hurt by someone in their life? Right, we need to think upstream about what's causing those and address those issues in order to truly prevent some of these negative outcomes. We need to think about what role does not being able to pay my rent because of how little I make at my minimum wage job play in my mental health. We need to think about what role does not knowing where my next meal is going to come from play and how I feel internally. Right? Those are not just community or poverty issues. Those are mental health issues too. The next thing you can do to help is advocate. Letters, emails, calls, conversations, votes. I know how important social justice is to the Unitarian Universalist community. I know this is sort of a preaching to the choir moment too, but I just encourage you to know that it actually does make a difference. I had a meeting with one of our state representatives for Hendricks County about 4 weeks ago, right in the middle of session, and session is still going right now at the State House. We were talking about these types of issues and what bills I think she should support, et cetera. And something she told me, what I was really surprised by, is that for some constituencies, there are literal tally mark boards in their offices of how many calls they get for or against an issue before they decide how they're going to vote. So if you think that your call doesn't matter, think again. Right? You might not get a response, or you might get that canned email response that says, thank you for emailing Representative so-and-so, and it has no personal engagement whatsoever, but please know that tally mark does matter. And if enough of us show up on that tally mark board that are voting members of their constituency or their district, it makes a difference in how those representatives will vote for certain bills. Educate yourself and others. Right? Share this information with someone that you might not know about. It might make them feel seen and heard, and that might be exactly what they need in those moments of hardship. Remember to practice good self-care, because it's really hard to be helpful to someone else if you're in the depths, right? So strategies like meditation, mindfulness, getting out into nature and going for a walk, feeding your body good foods, right? Not Cheez-Its and Oreos, like myself. Okay? Those good self-care techniques are really important for your own mental health. And it's important not to forget yourself in those moments. Be the friend, partner, family member, or colleague that offers a warm referral and professional treatment. It is okay to not be okay. It is okay to need help from someone who is licensed, like Sue, to give you that help, right? That is a good and perfect gift that's available to all of us. And it's super important that we be the people who say, you might need this and it's okay to call. I'll call with you. Let's put it on speakerphone. We are not alone making this phone call, because it can be nerve-wracking to go through the process and fill out the paperwork and answer the questions. It's a heavy thing. So be there to help someone lift that weight. Ultimately, compassion is the best starting place. And my favorite definition for compassion that I've ever heard is empathy in motion. Right? It doesn't mean you understand what someone else is going through. Most times you can't, right? But we can put ourselves in each other's shoes and just do our best to empathize. What's it feel like? And once we feel that empathy in our souls, we can put it in action. We can make something happen with that empathy. That's what compassion truly is. So do your best to try and find that compassion, to try and move with that compassion, and you'll make a difference in someone's lives. If you need help, please know the Willow Center is here for you as well. The Willow Center is a great place to seek treatment, both for substance use and mental health counseling. So if you're looking for a resource and you have someone in your life that might be looking for a resource and they need that additional service, you can always call us. We're accepting, we're affirming, we're a compassionate, inclusive group of people, and we do our best to provide help for everyone who needs it. Okay? Thank you. Appreciate it.